This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today, we start with a story from the September 1984 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Pieces of Eight by J.G. Carr. Pieces of Eight? Ark, ark, pieces of eight! The raucous cry split the air. Then the bird twisted its head to pick under its wings for fleas. Millie, called the husky boy man in the cut-off shirt and faded jeans. Millie, will you come and take a look at this, mother? Oh, Jake. She frowned over her shoulder, a well-built blonde in flaming pink halter and cut-off shorts that displayed a generous curve of buttock as well as the long length of model lovely legs. You come here. This black is adorable. No, you come here, he ordered petulantly, the immature whine in his voice contrasting with the easy maturity of solidly muscular body. What for? Still holding the squirming black clutched against her side with one arm, she sorted through the wriggling pile of fluff with the other. Because! This time it held more command and less whine. In a minute. She was balancing two kittens in her hand, as though the final decision would be made by weight. Her brows raised, and the pet shop proprietor, a well-preserved woman who wouldn't see 50 again, made a mew of between-us-girls understanding. A slight wriggle of Millie's left hand brought the ring with its minuscule diamond into prominence. The tight shorts waistband held its secret well, and the older woman saw, nodded, and her enlarged by pince-nez eyes flashed a message. Start as you would finish, sister. Millie grinned, nodding. I know what I'm doing. Aloud, almost too sweetly, she said, I'm coming, dear. The pet shop was so crowded with cages and stacks of all kinds of supplies that she had to maneuver, bending and twisting, just to get to Jake's side. Pieces of eight! The bird stopped picking at its feathers long enough to greet her. Ah, pretty Polly, pretty Polly. Then it fluffed out its chest and preened. It's so big, Millie gasped. Yes, he's a particularly lovely specimen of South American Amazon. The pet shop owner had followed Millie, though with more difficulty. Now she smoothed the bird's plumage with a proprietary hand. He talks well, as you can see, and his colors are so big. Millie clutched the kittens protectively to her body as though the curved beak would snatch them instead of the traditional cracker. Better than a yard from tip to tail, his mistress crowed. Of course, they do come larger if all you're interested in is mere size, but if you want well-trained speech and brilliant plumage, you can't do better than our friend here. Ark! Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight! Batten down the hatches! Pieces of eight! Repel boarders! Mug-a-rum! Mug-a-rum! He sounds like a pirate, taught him, giggled Millie. Ark! Pretty Polly! Pretty Polly! The bird coaxed. Polly want a cracker? Willie asked with another giggle. He does have an amazing vocabulary, the owner informed. I guess whoever trained him had quite a sense of humor. With a faint blush, she added, not all his comments are fit for mixed company. Holy shit! Bring on the wrenches! Mug-a-rum! Mug-a-rum! The parrot bore her out. If that's the worst, he says. Jake laughed with the ease of someone who'd used all the four-letter words so often they'd long since lost any meaning. Holy shit, Millie repeated. Maybe it's somebody who saw that movie, whatever it was, where those three women caught a man and hung him up in a harness. You remember, Jake, he was always saying holy shit. Hey, Jack, got a light? the parrot squawked, somehow managing an unmistakable leer. Well, he almost said my name then, Millie. Do you think? No, Jake, we agreed. A cat. You know the landlord's rule is no pets, but he did say that a litter-trained cat. But a bird in a cage? Jake, for heaven's sake, look at him. Can you imagine a bird that size in a cage? And whenever we let him out, I'd be cleaning up bird poop from all. You? Honey, you know we agreed to split the chores. If we took him, I'd clean up after him. Promise I will. The owner, smelling a much better sale than a mere kitten, broke in with, It's not as bad as you think. This one's well perch-trained. Keep papers under his perch, and that's all you need to do. And he is marvelously well-spoken. He must know 100 different phrases. Half an hour later, they were walking out the door, mumbling a confusion of instructions, Jake proudly bearing a covered cage. Jake, Millie was saying, as the door shut behind them with a satisfied ka-chunk, we're going to regret this. The proprietor, who had long since established who ran things in her household, shook her head. It's one thing to let the man think he's running the things, another to let him grasp the reins in reality. Millie, how long do parrots live? Oh, I don't know, 10 or 20 years, I suppose, like dogs or cats. She was rinsing the dishes prior to putting them in the automatic, and the smell of stale grease was making her stomach, sensitive to these days, churn. She shot a glare towards him over her shoulder that he remained luckily oblivious of. Equal shares. For an ex-swinging bachelor, he was suspiciously unadept at certain basic household chores. The ones he didn't like to do, she was sure. If this was going to be a modern, equal relationship, it's just, I was kind of thinking, I read somewhere that turtles could live a couple of 100 years. I just wondered if maybe parrots, his voice trailed off. If parrots, she wiped her hands on a paper towel, tossed it towards the open waste can, missed and shrugged. She'd get it when she took the garbage out. There were more exciting things to do. She hurried into their miniature living room, smiling. You think the old lady sold us a bummer, Jake? You think John Long John is too old to last? I don't know about lasting, but I think he's old. It's funny, honey. I've been listening to him off and on ever since we got him, and ah! Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight! Ah! Dead man's chest! Ah! The parrot crowed and flew around the small room with a flutter of wings that made Millie dash to save the tottering Wedgwood vase her ancient great-aunt Beatrice, the only relative she had left since the auto accident, had given her. Ah! Pretty Millie! Pretty Millie! The bird seemed to watch with malicious glee her efforts to rescue the teetering vase. How can you help listening to him? Millie sneered. Oh, shut up! She snapped at the bird. Ark! Mariner's Cove! Marooner's Cove! The bird unobediently proclaimed. Listen, Jake had been reading something. Now he closed the book with one finger, holding the place. Listen to him, Millie. You can hear. Some of what he says is in a different accent. It's as if, Holy shit! The bird screeched. And disproving once again the pet shop owner's claim, deposited a load on their sleeper sofa. Millie screeched louder than the bird and ran for the paper towels and the carpet upholstery shampooer. It had already become a routine. Grab what she could of the mess with the towels and use the shampoo to get as much of what was left as possible. That does it, Jake Muldoon. It goes. That filthy bird goes. Jake jumped to soothe her, metaphorical, ruffled feathers, a task he was becoming adept at with practice, and it wasn't until much later that evening, when they were both in the sleeper sofa made into a bed, almost ready to go to sleep, that he got back to the subject of the bird. "We'll get rid of Long John if you want, love, but I think he's kind of fun." "You clean up after him, then," she mumbled, already half asleep. "Oh, I will, I will," he promised, meaning it utterly, when he said it. "If you say so." "It's not just that I want him. I have this idea about him that I want to check out first. If it doesn't go..." "Remember you said that." "I said what?" Millie faced Jake in the immemorial female pose, hands on hips, except that one hand held a paper towel full of Long John poop, and the other a carpet shampooer sprayer that looked like she just might aim at Jake and clean him out of her life, too, just like the dirt. He couldn't stop a slight flush. "You said we could keep him just a little longer while I check something." She cocked her head and gave him a look not unreminiscent of Long John at his most sardonic. "Just when did I make this interesting statement?" "Last night." Her unbelieving face drove him on. "Late. Just before we went to sleep."
"Grapnels! Grapnels! Bored me hearties!" Long John contributed.
"Before you went to sleep," she snapped. The guilt was definitely wearing off her romantic dream. "Are you sure you didn't hear a snore and interpret it as a yes?" He flushed again. "I'm doing it for you. Don't you want a chance to get out of this ratty trap before we're both old and gray?" He had successfully sidetracked her. She finished cleaning up after the bird, mumbling, "You know we agreed. It's all we can afford now." "If we'd..." he started, but she cut him off. "We agreed. We agreed we could do without..." She shuddered. "You know what?" She stared up at him, eyes both accusing and pleading. "We can do it, Jake, if we both work hard and save, and you go to night school." He used a word that wasn't in Long John's vocabulary yet. "We'll work hard until you can't. You know you don't make enough to pay for sitters after, so it's all going to be me. Night school, sure, if I can, and if I pass, and if there's a job waiting when I do, honey." He knelt, taking both her hands, paper towels and shampoo and all. "Long John could get us out now." "Jake," she shook her head, "nobody or nothing is going to get us into or out of anywhere but us. It's a dog-eat-dog world, and if we don't take care of ourselves, who will? But we can do it, Jake. I know we can. Just work hard and stick to it, and..." "I already said I was willing," he said softly but firmly. "But if there's a better way, we'd be fools not to try for it instead of spending our lives slaving. Long John may be a slim chance, but..." "Oh, Jake," she said sadly, pulling away. She dumped the paper towel in the water can and put the shampoo on a handy shelf, then washed her hands at the tiny sink, sputtering some water on Long John, who rewarded her with his choicest curses, some of which were old-fashioned enough to make her giggle and restore her good humor. "I know what you're going at, Jake. The lady who sold him to us was wrong. He's not a South American what's-it after all. He's really a rare tutti-frutti bird from the wilds of outer Blankia, and the Audubon Zoo is willing to pay $1 million for him. As a matter of fact, I looked him up during my lunch hour today, and he doesn't quite fit any of the descriptions." She shrugged and perched her still-slim self on the edge of the old-fashioned grooved porcelain sink. "But that's not important," he went on. "What's important is the way he talks, and that parrots are known to live for a long, long time." He lowered his voice, as though there were someone to hear besides Millie and Long John, who had managed to swipe some of Jake's beer and was staggering around, gasping and proclaiming, "Drinkin' the devil! Drinkin' the devil! Jug of rum! Ah!" "Listen, Millie, damn it, listen. some of what he says sounds different. You know, when he says pieces of eight, it's really pices of eight. So, his voice sunk longer. Pices of eight, like a real pirate would say it. Oh, Jake. She started laughing so hard, she fell off her sink perch. You think a real pirate taught him? Why, there haven't been any real pirates for hundreds of years. You dumb Yankee, haven't you ever heard of Jean Lafitte? Oh, sure, and Blackbeard and Henry Morgan. You really think old Long John is about 300 or 400 years old? I don't know about the others. He glared at her and suddenly realized what was wrong with the staggering bird and hurriedly moved the rest of the beer out of temptation. Jean Lafitte fought with Andy Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans about 150 years ago, and he wasn't the only pirate around here then either, just the most famous one. She sat back on the floor with a loud plop. You're serious? You think Long John belonged to a pirate because you think he sounds like one? Sometimes, just sometimes. Listen, Marooner's Cave, Long John, Marooner's Cave. He did his best to give the last phrase the odd Cockney British tar accent he thought of as pirate.
Huh? Marooner's Cave? How tied? Middle of the cage. 50 pices and pieces of eight. Pieces of eight.
Jake, you're not serious about all this.
Maybe.
He glared around at peeling paint, errant appliances, walls so thin they knew their neighbor's business better than the neighbor's. This place, wouldn't you do almost anything to get out of here, Millie?
Well, it's no use, Jake. We've checked every atlas here. There is no Marooner's Cove.
Jake and Millie stared disconsolately at each other over the hard wooden surface of the library table.
May I help you? Said the wiry man with the neat mustache.
No, I don't think, Jake started, but Millie interrupted him.
Maybe you can, Millie awarded the man her best smile.
A friend of ours was telling us a story about her great-grandparents. It seems they lived a long time in a place called Marooner's Cove. Jane didn't know where it was, but it sounded terrific. Well, our vacation is coming up, and besides the swimming and fishing and beach and all, it would be fun to take snaps to show Jane where her own folks lived long ago. Only her best helpless look. We can't find anything about it. The librarian pursed his lips. Can't say I've heard of it either. Sounds like something out of Treasure Island, you know. Millie squeaked, but Jake managed a weak, never read it.
You should. It's not just a classic. It's very enjoyable. One of the characters is called Ben Gunn. He's been marooned on the island, the Treasure Island, for years. And when the treasure seekers come, the glazed look in two pairs of eyes told him he had lost his audience. He sighed, but knew better, from long experience, than to continue to push his own enthusiasm. Well, let's see where you've been looking. Why, these are all modern atlases. Hasn't it occurred to you that Marooner's Cove might be a local name and an old one that wouldn't likely be listed here?
Oh, Jake sighed glumly. But if you were to look at some of the older atlases in the restricted section, or an historical atlas or two.
Older atlases?
Yes, pride made him glow. We have atlases going all the way back to the early 1800s. There's a handwritten one under glass, I'm afraid, that goes back prior to the Battle of New Orleans.
He smiled at the sudden hope on two young faces. Usually we don't let any but legitimate scholars back in the restricted areas, but you just want that one item of information. It would be a pleasant surprise for your friend now, wouldn't it? I think I can trust it. We're in big trouble. Jake scowled as he kicked a pebble into the street, not looking back at the facade of the library. But we know where it is now. We found it on the old map and matched it to the new one. It can't be more than a couple of hours away. I just thought, he moaned, beach. There's a whole string of beaches along the coast. If they're not public and full of vacationers and swimmers, they'll be private, and we'll be trespassing. So? Millie shrugged, causing at least two male passers-by to trip over their own feet while staring. So what? We'll just locate the place during the day and come back at night. But suppose it is private property. You know, we could never afford to buy beach property. We can't afford, she gave him her best, your dumb look. Finders keepers, she said briskly. But who started this get out of the apartment anyway, she sneered. What's the matter? You decided you like cockroaches? He had to grin. Haven't been any since Long John came. You think he eats them? If so, it's the one useful thing about him, she muttered. Then louder, you were the one who said do anything, weren't you? Two shadowy figures crept through the long, uncut weeds towards the strip of sand, shimmering ghost-like in the pale quarter moonlight. A blade clinked against a rock. Hush! Hissed Jake. Be careful! There aren't any houses anywhere near, Millie spat back. We've walked miles. No houses we've seen, Jake retorted, low-voiced. Who knows what's around here?
Pieces of meat!
Squawked a muffled voice. Keep him quiet, Jake snarled. You keep him quiet, Millie bit out. You're the one who insisted on bringing him. Because he might say something, I know. Sure, he's going to. Ouch! I said be quiet. How can you be quiet when you're falling? She was already scrambling back to her feet, gathering her equipment. I told you we needed flashlights. And I told you. We don't want somebody seeing the lights and investigating. My ankle hurts. Can you walk on it? He gritted out, reluctantly. Yes. Then come on. We've only got a few hours. We've 2 weeks. We both took off for two. I know that, he said with an impatient snort. But do you really think if whoever owns this place comes and finds holes that we've dug, we'll be able to come back the next night and do some more digging without somebody waiting, maybe with guns? Sure, with the fuzz. Oh, I didn't think. You never do, she flinched, knowing what he was referring to, though it was his fault as much as hers. Come on. She followed the steady thump of his footsteps, muttering, here we are. He began dumping his equipment any which way on the sand. Jake, she wailed, seeing something as she bent to follow suit. Jake, I tore my jeans on that barbed wire. I'll buy you new ones, he muttered, looking left and right, trying to locate the midline of the tiny beach. Designer ones with real gold trim. I'm bleeding. Oh, for if we miss low tide, we won't be able to. Let me see, he finished as she wailed again. Skin looks and feels smooth, he announced, after kneeling and inspecting the damage. It must have just been a shat click. It was no louder than a light switch, but a blacker than black cylinder of something sprang up around them. Yet, despite the blackness of whatever surrounded them, there was light. A strange yellow-green glow that seemed to have no single origin. It just existed. Millie screeched and grabbed at Jake. Jake gulped and grabbed at Millie. From the heights of the cylinder, a figure began descending slowly, rather like a man riding in a glass elevator, except that there wasn't any sign of an elevator. and the figure couldn't possibly have been a man. "Run, Millie!" Jay called her to her feet and charged for the nearest black curves, meaning to smash through and keep on running. Except that he merely bounced off the black surface, spilling himself and Millie neatly to the ground, now also a smooth black, while the whatever it was landed as softly as a dandelion puff. Jake and Millie stared, unbelieving. It was roughly the height of a man, and there all resemblance ended. Four elephantine legs supported a bulbous body with no indication of head or neck, but with a scatter of arms or tentacles or something. The major color was a sort of burnt orange with patches of olive green and indigo blue that could have been coverings of some sort or merely chunks of loose skin. A low rumble issued out of it from somewhere, and Millie screeched again and buried her face in her hands. "Lay one hand on Millie, whatever you are," Jake challenged, squaring his shoulders and clenching his fists. Paying neither of them any heed, the being sauntered over, its four legs lending it a definite rolling gait to the pile of equipment. One of its arms snaked the cover off Long John's cage. Another swift movement, and the cage was open, and the bird hopped out. "About time, Loisovich!" he squawked. The being rumbled. "Local language, Loisovich. Local language. English. Sent you the gen. Here, take a look. Brought you the new cargo. How do you like it?" The being didn't turn, but Jake shivered. He'd had the sudden feeling of tiny fingers sieving through his body, poking through his mind with careless, casual ease. Beside him, Millie gasped and shuddered, and he tightened the arm he'd put around her shoulders. The alien rumble that might have been speech filled the black cylinder. "Now when have I ripped you off, Loisovich? These are young and healthy, a breeding pair, no less." "Long John!" Millie gasped in outrage. Then her eyes widened as she put it together before Jake could sort out breeding pair and be insulted. "Long John, what have you done?"
"Ach, pieces of meat,"
he snickered. "Then, given what you wanted so much, Millie, I've gotten you out of that ratty apartment."
"But I never wanted..."
She started sobbing. "What's going on?" Jake clenched his fists again, ready to fight. If only he knew whom and where.
"He sold us," Millie sniffed, "to that thing."
"What?" Jake exclaimed, while the thing rumbled again.
"Tell them you'll be nice, Loisovich,"
Long John snickered. "In English,
be nice."
It sounded like a train speaking, but was reasonable, understandable.
"Come with me, Loisovich. Be good, good."
"No,"
Millie screamed, while Jake agreed. "Not on your life." Long John produced a braying cackle. "Don't worry, Jake. He'll clean up after you've ship-trained. And he never separates a breeding pair, especially not Terran lovebirds."
"But Long John, why?" Millie said numbly.
"Pieces of eight," he said, with an avian shrug. "We don't use your money, or money as such, but we have an equivalent. If you must know, I'm working my way through, call it college." Another raucous cackle. "It's a dog-eat-dog universe, remember, Millie? If I don't take care of me, who will?"
"No!"
Jake leapt for Loisovich, fits pounding, but he never got there. Out of nowhere, it seemed, glittering strands wrapped around him. Between one step and the next, he became a mummy and began to fall. But even as he lost his balance, he was rising, his struggles muted by the strands, but not his curses.
"Jake!"
Millie sailed to her feet, her arms outstretched after the disappearing figure. "He'll be okay, Millie," Long John informed, "and you'll be back together soon. Just remember, Loisvitch allows every dog one bite, and he prefers the carrot to the stick, though he will use the stick. Not to worry. You two are bright kids, fast learners. You'll be fine. I want to go home."
"You be good, good. I be good, good," Loisvitch rumbled.
"I want to go home." "Your home's with Loisvitch now." From the top of the cylinder, another figure floated down. This one was a man, dressed in casual clothes, jeans, and a t-shirt. As soon as his feet touched, Millie flung herself at him. "Mister, help me. Get me out of here. Do something." But the man just stood, in the same pose he had landed in, and Long John cackled again. "He's not real, Millie. He's just a programmed mechanical. He's going to take me." She flinched away, as though the unmoving figure had suddenly gotten red hot. "To another pet store," she accused, "so you can be sold again and catch another victim. What do you do?" Her lips curled in a sneer. "If your new owner isn't suitable." He cackled. "I hook a friend, then. Pieces of eight. The right bait, and I can take my choice." The mechanical held out an arm, and Long John hopped onto it and preened a wing. The mechanical started towards the nearest black curve. "Long John, you can't do this. Didn't I take care of you?"
"Sure, Millie. Give you something in return." Omnius snuffed.
The pair were stepping through the wall.
"Omnius snuffed? What's that, Long John?" she cried frantically.
But they were through, and there was a sensation of rising as a slow but smooth elevator. Long John's answer echoed thinly. "Pieces of eight!" We continue with a story from the December 1983 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Precious Thing by Barbara Owens. Some unfortunate souls seem to be born victims. Harriet Wirtz was one. From a solid, lumpy baby, she traveled uneasily into a stolid, lumpy child. A sideliner, easy to intimidate and eager to please, never expecting much, never disappointed. Her adolescence was distinguished by four dates, not one of them a repeater. Harriet arrived at maturity, large and pale, shaped like an egg, peering anxiously at the world through thick lenses, long resigned to never having things work out. She seldom looked anyone in the eye. When she was on the downhill side of 30, Max Wirtz found her. Harriet's secret heart revived ancient, young dreams of cozy chintz evenings at home, with little feet pity-patting through the house. She overlooked Max's runty, ape-like body, his thin ferret face. She hadn't been introduced yet to his dark, warty soul. When Max announced he'd decided to marry her, she was grateful. She didn't know Max's secret dream. He looked forward to a long and happy lifetime of torment. Their wedded life was never bliss. Soon, Harriet discovered that some souls are born to be bullies, and she had gotten the prize. She never learned any deep-rooted psychological reasons for his nature. Gradually, she came to accept the fact that Max just enjoyed being mean. He hated everything and everybody, with one possible exception. He was ecstatic with their marriage and with her, for Harriet in domesticity was wondrous to behold. Things leapt off shelves and tables at her approach, smashing into pieces at her feet, Pots and pans slid off the stove on sight of her, splattering their contents wildly. Her pitiful attempts at decorating their apartment set Max into rapture. She could always be counted on to catch or maim some part of her body in household appliances, instead of erasing her husband's shameful ring around the collar. Harriet was resigned to winding up with a finger hopelessly trapped in the stain remover bottle. And Max was always there, at her side, cheering her on. His happiest times were the rare occasions when unsuspecting guests could be snared for dinner. He would have Harriet quivering before their arrival, humiliate her throughout the meal, then top it off by inviting the visitors into the kitchen while she straightened up just to watch her break things. This was all unpleasant for Harriet, of course, but her biggest disappointment was the absence of those little feet pitty-patting through the house. "Are you kidding?" Max had raised his eyebrows in mock horror at her shy suggestion. "You'd probably drop 'em on their heads. No, sir. And no doggies, kitties, fishies, or birds that go tweet, tweet, nothing. I hate 'em all." Sometimes in the beginning, Harriet mustered enough courage to answer back. But after Max bounced her head off the wall a few times, she gave up. She subsided into a silent, accepting shadow, dully living out her due. Their marriage was 10 glorious years old on the day that Max, a plumbing contractor, had to go out of town on business. He left Harriet with a little money, not much, but she was accustomed to less. Feeling an uncharacteristic urge, a restlessness, Harriet decided to celebrate by indulging in a favorite pastime, strolling through a nearby shopping mall. She never bought anything, but she liked to window shop and watch the people, and no one ever paid attention to a large pale egg with glasses. It was a fresh spring day, the kind when everything seemed larger than life. Harriet mingled in the crowded mall, watching, listening, pausing now and then to sit on a bench, looking at the people going by. She was doing just this when someone joined her on the bench. Quickly, without making eye contact, Harriet rose and hurried away. Directly in front of her was a florist shop. The display in its window caught her eye. Plants and flowers sprawled in jungle abandon, bright, green, freshly dewed. They were beautiful. It looked so quiet and peaceful inside. Without realizing it, she stepped through the door. The air inside was cool and sweet, smelling of moist, rich earth and fragile bloom. Harriet smiled, breathing deep. No one was in sight. Hesitantly, she crept across the floor, nearsighted eyes watchful for the towers of clay pots that seemed designed for her to knock them crashing, the hanging macrame shoulders waiting to snare an arm or leg or neck, green everywhere. Beautiful glossy leaves, rich glowing colors. Harriet was lost in a new world. The young clerk was at her side before she saw him. "May I help you, ma'am?" "Oh." Harriet stumbled backwards, startled. Her elbow bruised a tower of pots, and she felt like crying. But the tower didn't fall, and the young clerk smiled kindly. "Were you looking for something in particular?" "What? No, I was just looking." She tried to edge away, but she backed into a corner between two stacks of pots. There was no way out. She trembled, trapped, eyes focused on the young man's shiny shoes. I wouldn't be any good at growing things," she mumbled apologetically. "Are you sure? We may have just the thing for you, on special, Nephrolepis bostoniensis, easiest plant in the world to grow." Harriet licked her lips. "Nephro what?" He smiled wider. "Boston fern. Come here, I'll show you. She was steered helplessly across the floor to a large hanging display near the rear. Now look, the clerk said, aren't they pretty? And believe me, there's nothing to making them grow. Harriet couldn't raise her eyes above the clerk's left shoulder. She uttered weakly. What do you think? I'll give you some tips. Want to try it? She would have bought the shop if he had offered it. I'll take one, she whispered. Can I go now? Mutely, she waited while he boxed it and removed a sweaty bill from her palm. Just give it good light, plenty of water, and love. You'll be surprised how quickly it responds. Thank you, and please come again. Harriet marched blindly homeward, with the fern held stiffly at arm's length. Life, water, good love, she whispered to herself. Good water, love, light. Once it was installed in the living room window, she stood back to have a look. It'll die, she said aloud, and remembered. And Max will kill me. We're both going to die, she assured the fern calmly. But it looked so pretty there, tender young fronds just beginning their graceful droop. Where'd you get that thing? Were Max's first words. What is it, some kind of weed? You better not have spent any money on it. Get it out of here, Harriet. I don't like its looks. Harriet swallowed hard. Max, can't I keep it, please? It's just a little plant. Max's eyes narrowed. He started to speak, but there was something in Harriet's voice that stopped him. He thought. Finally, he nodded, mouth twisting into what might pass for a smile. Well, okay, just keep it out of my way. Oh, thank you, Max, thank you. His generosity was soon explained. While Harriet would be preparing a wretched dinner, Max would hand her a fistful of crumpled green leaves. Fiddle something extra for the salad, he'd offer innocently. And Harriet would utter a little moan. Hey, Harriet, come here. At her dutiful appearance, he'd hold a lighted match under a soft frond. Look how that thing curls up. The look on Harriet's face would send him chortling from the room. Despite his treatment, the young ferns began to grow. Established leaves lengthened, and each day there seemed to be new ones, furry little heads poking through the black dirt, beginning almost immediately to unroll into slender young fronds. Harriet was enchanted. She watched it, hung over it, counted the new shoots every day. Look, just look at all the babies. Oh, lovely. You're precious. You precious, precious thing. She took out a library card, bringing home books by the armload on plants and their proper care. She watered it, fed it, misted its lacy foliage until it glistened, talked to it constantly. Sometimes she imagined she heard a soft answering whisper somewhere deep in its leaves. You're talking to it now? Max jeered, coming up on her unexpectedly one day. What are you doing, Harriet? Getting weird? Harriet flushed, embarrassed. Well, some books say they respond to love, she murmured, avoiding his eyes. He snorted. Yeah? How do the books say they respond to this? He covered the fern with a heavy cloud of cigar smoke, laughing at Harriet's stricken face. Oh, precious thing, I'm sorry, she whispered after Max had gone. Did he hurt you? He isn't very nice sometimes, but don't worry, I'll take care of you. This time she was almost certain she heard a soft rustling in its leaves. As Precious Thing continued to thrive, Harriet started holding back some of her household money. When she had enough, she journeyed back to the florist shop, returning with a delicate young spider plant. She hung it next to Precious Thing on the wall. Precious, this is Lulu. Lulu, Precious Thing.
I know you girls will get along just fine. Max had a fit, but surely two plants would be more fun to torture than one, and he relented. As Lulu grew, Harriet became possessed. She read everything on houseplants she could find. One whole kitchen cabinet was stuffed with fertilizer, sprays, vitamins, and clever plant care tools. New plants kept appearing. After an ornamental fig materialized one day, Max put his foot down. Absolutely no more money would be spent on weeds. Harriet was to keep an account book, and he would review it weekly. He wanted to know where each and every penny went. Obediently, Harriet agreed. She kept her account book and, without thinking twice, began stealing small bills and spare change from Max's pockets, hiding them until she had enough to buy another plant. Max was at a loss. She wouldn't tell him where she was getting money, not even after a smack or two. He didn't know how to handle Harriet anymore. Within a year, the apartment was alive with plant life. Ferns, ivies, philodendrons, caladiums, even a statuesque anthurium named Daphne. Precious Thing had outgrown two containers and was still going. Her fronds cascaded 5 feet to the floor, and three grown men holding hands couldn't have reached around her. Everything Harriet touched grew. She was beginning to explore the care and tending of tropical orchids. One of her greatest joys was to sit quietly in the apartment, listening to the multitude of sighs and whispers as the plants talked to one another. Gradually, she was beginning to understand them. Although she wasn't sure of it, Harriet had changed. She seldom dropped things anymore. She hadn't been caught in the sweeper for months. Even her egg shape had trimmed noticeably. One day, two ladies from her building came knocking at her door. They'd heard from the super, they said, that Mrs. Wirtz had a way with plants. They belonged to the Gracie Street Garden Club, they said. And might they come inside and see? Harriet was so astonished at having visitors that she let them in. And they were almost speechless. They were so impressed with what they saw. We have never, never seen a Boston fern that big, they assured her solemnly. All your plants are the largest of their kind, I'm sure. Whatever is your secret, dear? Harriet blushed furiously. I just love them all, I guess. Straight away, they asked her to join their club, and before she thought about it, she said yes. Max almost swallowed his cigar when he heard Ratty Face only inches from hers, as he impressed upon her his intention that she wouldn't. Harriet's hands twisted together, but she looked straight down into his eyes and said calmly, I understand your feelings, Max, but I've decided that I will. His consternation was so great, he couldn't lift a finger against her. Harriet joined the Gracie Street Garden Club. Max took to drink. Almost immediately, Harriet found herself in demand. The neighborhood newspaper ran pictures of Precious Thing on its garden page. The feature was an interview with Harriet. Soon, she was being invited to speak to other garden clubs. At first, she refused, but finally she did and was overcome with her success. People listen to me. Sometimes they actually applaud, she announced to her assemblage. The answering sighs and rustlings were a fervent echo of that applause. Max still mistreated the plants at every opportunity, particularly Precious Thing. But they continued to thrive in spite of him, and even Harriet didn't react as she used to. Once, she even asked him politely to stop. Something had gone wrong somewhere. In the spring, a group of the club ladies asked Harriet if they could submit her name for president in the upcoming election. She was overwhelmed. Can you imagine? She told Precious Thing. Isn't it exciting? Just days before the election,
Eunice Grubb called Harriet on the phone. Eunice had a neck like a turkey and was chairlady of the nominating committee. She informed Harriet that she had personally discouraged the ladies from submitting her as their nominee. "I thought it only right that I tell you this myself," she added magnanimously. "You have lovely plants, and we're proud to have you as a member, but you are new to the club, and perhaps not quite the image we look for in a president." The ladies decided to submit Eunice's name instead. "I hope you understand." Harriet blinked several times and said she understood. Her heart ached at the sad sighs her plants emitted when they received the news. That night, Max came home nasty. He was getting ready to leave for an out-of-town lodge convention. His personal celebration had already begun. All through dinner, he sneered and snarled at Harriet. Nothing she said or did was right. He was still muttering to himself as he started weaving towards the bedroom to pack his bag. Harriet began gathering up dirty dishes. Suddenly, there was a loud cry and a crash resounded from the living room. Max was pulling himself up off the floor as Harriet rushed in. Precious Thing teetered precariously on her stand. Max glared at Harriet. "That stinking fern tripped me." He lurched sideways and fell again, slamming into the fern stand. Harriet leapt forward, but it was to protect Precious Thing, not aid Max, and he saw. He came up off the floor, little eyes red and mean. "All right, Harriet, all right," he hissed. "You've done it now, kid. Out. They all go out." She was paralyzed. Not one muscle could she move as a maidenhair fern crashed with a sickening thud to the floor. A young ivy sailed across the room, smashing against the wall. More followed, and more, and as each fell, shattered. Max trampled tender roots and soil into the rug. His frenzy grew, spittle spraying as he waded through the destruction. "See? See, Harriet? Look at this." He cast longing eyes on Precious Thing, but knew he couldn't lift her. He settled on Lulu, snatching her off her hook and holding her outstretched, eyes boring into Harriet's. "Gone, Harriet," he panted. "When I get back, every damn one of them gone. You hear?" She watched Lulu flying towards her, but couldn't move. Max's drunken aim sent the heavy pot catapulting into the wall beside her head. She heard the explosion and felt a thin chip slice her just above the eye. Dimly, she watched Max stagger from the room. Then her ears were filled with a sound like high winds moaning through distant trees. While Max yodeled drunkenly in the shower, she lifted $50 from his wallet. After he'd gone, repeating he'd be home Sunday, and if she knew what was good for her, she cleaned and bandaged her face, then spent half the night salvaging every plant she could and repairing the damage to the living room. Next morning, she took the $50, marched resolutely to the florist shop, and arranged for delivery of replacements for every lost one. "I just don't know what to do," she worried, tamping fresh new soil and nearsightedly ladling out B1. "I can't go anywhere. I have nowhere to go. I don't know what I'll do, but I won't give you all up." On Saturday night, she was desperate. She still had no solution. Head aching, she went to bed and spent a fitful night. Once she woke in the dark, heart pounding day morning, she was met with the dark brown smell of stale cigars. Wondering, she stepped into the living room and stopped short. Precious Thing looked like an example of an unusual Christmas tree. Bits and pieces of color festooned her lacy green leaves. Harriet reached for her glasses and peered closer. Shredded scraps of a red plaid jacket, chewed bits of shoe leather, messy chunks of a bright yellow tie, a wallet and gold lodge ring lay, rejected, on the floor. For a long time, Harriet just looked. "My goodness," she said finally. Looks like Max came home early. Precious Thing burped, a discreet, ladylike sound. She looked decidedly mussed and ruffled. Harriet sat down and thought things out. After a while, she gathered each bit of Precious Thing's decorations and burned them in a bucket. Then she got dressed, drove Max's car far across town, and abandoned it in front of a massage parlor, leaving his empty wallet and monogrammed gold lodge ring inside. It took her over an hour by bus to reach her home again. Delighted sighs and warm golden sunshine greeted her as she opened her front door. Harriet spent a long while caring for her plants. Then, humming, she brewed a pot of coffee and made hot cinnamon toast. She ate it in the living room, lounging back on the sofa, feet propped on the coffee table, a large jaunty egg with a bandage over her eye. "Precious Thing, I've been thinking," she said, munching contentedly. "Remember me telling you about Eunice Grubb, the one with the long stringy neck? I think I'll ask her to dinner sometime soon to show I understand. You think perhaps you might like that?" This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.